Virginia Woolf said it, and I believe it to be true. One cannot think well, love well, sleep well, if one has not dined well. That being the case, we ask, which country should we have for dinner?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 741st edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Singapore who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Hitting What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Folks, I don't know about you, but I love adventures. And as the son of Captain Hungry Olson, I especially love adventures in food. And so when I ran across restaurant critic Danielle Freeman's book, Try This, and opened its pages to Danielle's description of Korean kimchi, and found my mouth watering to the prospect of eating that stuff, I thought, it's time to head out for some adventuring around the world of food. And so to take the first step today, we're going to ask this crazy question. Which country should we eat for dinner tonight? And who better to ask than the restaurant girl herself, Danielle Freeman, who's the host of RestaurantGirl.com and author of Try This. Welcome to the Food Chain, Danielle. Pleasure to have you aboard.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
So, the restaurant girl, how did you become a restaurant girl? And you are the restaurant girl, right? You're the food critic. You have a website that's therestaurantgirl.com, and you are the restaurant critic.
Well, you know, it all started when I sort of became the incidental Dear Abby of food, and either started giving my unsolicited opinion on where people should eat or what people should eat, and everyone just started coming to me, and I earned the nickname Restaurant Girl, and it grew from there. I took a little leap of faith. It was about, you know, 6 years ago, so you could really still distinguish yourself on the internet, and started my website, and it just sort of blossomed and took off, and I ended up becoming the restaurant critic for the Daily News, and, you know, I sold my book to HarperCollins, which is my pride and joy because I really worked hard on it.
A fun book. Like I said, I opened a book to the section on Korean food, and I found myself, I gained 50 pounds just reading that section. It was incredible. Nice work.
Can you imagine how much weight I've gained?
So how do you...
Doing due diligence on this book.
Well, that's the question I had to ask, because in your photographs, you don't look like you've gained a lot. So how do you eat your way around New York City restaurants without gaining all that weight?
Well, you know what? Honestly, I'm somewhat miffed as well, but I believe it's because I pick and choose my battles. I have a big appetite. People look at me and they say, oh, she must eat like a bird. But that couldn't be farther from the truth. For the most part, I usually eat more than the men sitting at the table with me. And in an ideal world, if I didn't gain any weight at all, I would probably, you know, finish everybody's plates for them. But I know that's not the case. And I think one thing I actually discovered my journey around the world with eating and researching was that the world's foods offer so many amazing and actually healthy alternatives, ironically. So I really just, you know, discovered the world's foods and the world's comfort foods, but the world also has so many health foods as well. Like, for instance, a Thai, you know, classic papaya salad, they dress their salads, European standards usually dress your salad with oil or cream-based dressing, but there it's generally, you know, fish sauce and lime juice and maybe a little honey or sugar, but that's about it. And, you know, so you're eating something that's very gratifying but also very nourishing at the same time. And that's true of so many of the cuisines we go into. I mean, just the other day I was eating vinegared aloe at a Japanese izakaya here in New York City. And, you know, aloe is great for you. It's great for inflammation. It's great for digestion. And, you know, it was actually one of my... I still discover new foods along the way, and it was my first time eating aloe just for the sake of eating aloe,
mm-hmm.
and that was a very fun, cool, slippery feeling in my mouth, and perfect for summer. So,
well, let me ask you about New York City folk. Having been bouncing around New York City a few times myself, I come to realize that nobody eats in there, do they?
Yeah, that's funny. I was just having that conversation. No, and I think it's because the temptations outside your home are too big, and there are so many, you know, restaurants in New York, not to mention the mm-hmm. restaurants that open every day, that you feel almost guiltier not going out of the house to discover, you know, a new restaurant or try something new.
I also figured it was because New York City is a city of people, and, you know, you have people stacked up millions of feet high into the air, and you know, why bother eating alone when there's so many people to meet and greet and get to know?
Yeah, why bother eating alone, and also why bother eating in when you can discover, you know, a new dish, a new cuisine, a new region practically every single time you go out to eat? There really is, like, an amazing restaurant or food or tamale or bodega or, you know, cart in every corner in New York. It's a very exciting place. But that's not to say, like, this book isn't just New York-centric. I mean,
right.
You really can eat anywhere in the world right here in America these days.
Which
really
is the fun part, yeah. And before we eating our way around the world and eating up all of these beautiful countries.
By the way, Michael, we also don't have big kitchens here.
Ah.
So that discourages people from cooking in their house as well.
That's right. We live in apartments in New York City, right, with little tiny kitchens.
Yeah, they maybe fit one person. Everybody would rather, you know, go eat in someone else's house and let them do the cooking in their bigger kitchen.
Right. So with respect to being a restaurant critic, I've always wondered about being a restaurant critic, of course, having run across a couple of them. And I remember one of them, a great big huge guy named McFadden, believe it or not, who was a restaurant critic. And he went to criticize the restaurant my wife happened to be working in, which is a white tablecloth restaurant. And he sat down, he plunked himself down, his great big self down in the chair, and said, "I am McFadden, the restaurant critic." Do you do things like that to kind of let the world know that you're there, you're going to examine their restaurant and let the world know about it? How do you go about doing that?
I would never do that. I think that is sort of the opposite. But that is the opposite approach I would take, or perhaps that a restaurant critic normally should take, because the point is to not announce yourself. I mean,
right.
I was, having said that, I was the first non-anonymous restaurant critic. So I didn't believe that you had to be anonymous to objectively review a restaurant. That doesn't mean I went to a restaurant and announced myself. I called, you know, with block numbers. I gave different names. So if the chef wasn't in that night, he wasn't going to be in that night. If they didn't buy good produce, they didn't have good produce in the kitchen when I walked in. But I felt it was more important to give my readers someone to identify with, because that was something I was missing and one of the reasons that I started writing Restaurant Girl in the first place. I didn't know who was passing along information or their opinion and whether it was somebody, you know, some sort of curmudgeon that just, you know, didn't like...
Right.
Things. I needed someone to relate to, so I created that for myself. But no, I would never walk in and do that. I mean, then, of course, you're getting special attention, special treatment, acting like a diva.
So, but being a restaurant critic also requires a personality, too, and that's what your readers are looking for, too, right? Because you're part of the adventure. Yeah, you're part of this adventure. Your opinion, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you're a storyteller at the end of the day. And so you go to a restaurant, you know, if you're doing your due diligence right, you go 3 to 5 times if you're going to formally review a restaurant. And when you do, you're really just observing. You're observing the people around you. You're observing the food in front of you. You're observing the service. You're observing how other people are experiencing the restaurant. And so much goes on. I mean, I restaurants are my happy place. They're very exciting for me because so much goes on and there is so much discovery and socialization. And it's really, you know, this place that we all come together and share things, and it's an opportunity to share. So, you know, I think that there are these wonderful, amazing places. And I also think when you talk about, like, eating in versus eating out, and you think about a restaurant, like a Mexican restaurant that has a chef solely devoted to making mole, And that's all they do. And I know lots of restaurants around the country like that. They're just the mole chef.
Wow.
Or they just make the soft corn tortillas. That's amazing, you know? That's devotion. That's passion. That's something I want to try. That's something put their heart and soul into. That's what gets me excited, is these chefs with passion and these, you know...
Kind of like going to a rock concert, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's how I got into food in the first place. You know, I found myself, I was living in L.A., and I was flying back to New York for openings of restaurants like Union Pacific back when Rocco DiSpirito had just done Union Pacific right before he did, you know, the restaurant and stopped doing restaurants. And, you know, some people fly in for theater or movies, but that was my big premiere, and it was exciting, you know, to be there and sample the first bites that came out of that kitchen.
Yay. Right back, folks. This is my Michael Olson Food Chain Radio Program with Danielle Freeman, host of the RestaurantGirl.com and the author of Try This, and we will try this when we get back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about eating our way around the world. In which country are we going to eat tonight at the dinner table? With Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com, a restaurant critic in the city of New York City, but she also eats her way around the world and knows lots of other places as well. And also the author of Try This. And I tried that, and it was delicious. I think, like I said, I gained 50 pounds eating about Korean cooking, which isn't easy to do, but it was sure delicious. Danielle, before we start eating our way around the world, I have to ask, if there were such a thing as an American food restaurant, and a good one, what would it serve?
An American food restaurant.
Right.
Wow, that's my next book, Michael. you know... American food is such an amazing, amazing thing and so diverse. You know, it's as diverse as the world's foods. And I really think, you know, we haven't quite gotten our due yet. But we're getting there. And so I think it honestly really depends where you are in the country. Like, if you're in New England, you're going to have a lobster roll and you're going to have a chowder and you might have a whoopie pie. And so it really depends where you are. I mean, if you're... You know, down south, you might have southern cooking that's not barbecue, or, you know, you might have different kinds of barbecue depending on where you are, or have warring factions, right? But I mean, American food is an amazing thing. It's everything from po' boys and jambalaya, you know, to Tex-Mex, to, you know, just...
To really all of these ethnic country foods that we're going to be talking about now, right?
And marrying American, you know, and seasonal American ingredients to them, which produces a whole sort of new genre of cooking within these different, you know, regional cuisines.
Well, let's start eating away around the world. And, you know, when I opened up Try Me, I just threw it open to the Korean cooking, which floored me because being a Montana boy, that food sounded really good. But the thing, I guess, that I found most surprising was that you open your book with a discussion of food from Great Britain and of all the places in the world that I would not go restaurant touring about would be England, and yet there it is, number one on your list there. So how did on earth did that happen?
Well, that's actually what inspired my book, was a dinner at the Spotted Pig, which is a very well-known gastropub in New York City. And I actually had gone for my birthday with a bunch of well-educated, well-eaten people who live in New York and eat out, you know, 5 to 6 nights a week. And Everybody opened their menu and silence fell across the table, and nobody knew what roll mops were or devils on horseback or bangers and mash.
Spotted
and,
dick.
Yeah, I didn't know if we were allowed to say that on the radio.
I just got away with it.
And haggis and all those things. And I went home to look, you know, the next day I went to a bookstore to look for some sort of guide or reference with definitions, and I couldn't find one. And I realized that was true of so many cuisines. So I decided to write one myself because we really do eat in this new world of food. And once upon a time, you didn't go, as I say in the book, to England to eat at all. You went maybe for high tea or to see Big Ben and Parliament and all those places. But I think food was the last thing on your mind. And if it was, it would be Indian food. But nowadays, that's just not true at all. We have amazing gastropubs and traditional British food and even fish and chip shops, you know.
Now, when you say gastropub, what's that? What is a gastropub?
Well, it's sort of a loose term that combines gastronomy and a pub. So, you know, a traditional British pub. And the reason they came
Which traditionally sold really bad food.
100%. But then all of a sudden, in England, when the economy turned, these pubs had to go up for rent, and all these chefs, these ambitious, you know, chefs with pedigrees, took over these pubs and started serving, you know, ambitious food, and thus the gastropub was born, and they, you know, made their way to America, and that was that. And, you know, people really use it, honestly, the term really just means these days that it's pub food, so it's comfort food.
Mm-hmm. So you can eat here and you can drink here.
Yes, eat here, you can drink here, but now there's seasonality to it, mm-hmm. and there's some drive and ambition in the kitchen, and that makes all the difference in the world. And suddenly, like, it's not grim bar food. Suddenly it's something innovative and creative and exciting, but simultaneously comforting.
And you talk a lot about pickled foods. And what place do they have on the gastropub?
Well, pickled foods are essential, especially in the British gastropub of it all, because their season's so short and, you know, it rains so much and it's cold, and so they really have to take all those vegetables and, you know, eat as many as they can fresh and then pickle the rest so they can eat them the rest of the year. And that's really what, you know, gave food some flavor and life over there. You know, you serve a Plowman's lunch and you couldn't imagine having it without pickles. And they started pickling everything, pickled herring, and they love pickles over there. And that's true not just of England, but of so many cultures, Korean cultures and Japanese cultures. And, you know, I love pickles of the world. I really come to appreciate them. But really it was a survival mechanism to, you know, preserve the food as much as possible, and then we just acquired a taste for it.
And there's a lot of nutritional benefit, is there not, in eating pickled foods, too? It's with respect to how we digest our foods and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. And even more so than that is Korean kimchi, which doesn't have the brine or the vinegar that pickled foods have, so it's more fermented in chilies and a red pepper paste of it all, and that is even more because it's so good for your digestion, so good for your stomach, and that's why so many other cultures now are, you know, integrating kimchi into their menus, whether it be, I've seen it on seafood menus, I've seen it on so many American menus, I've just seen it in people's refrigerators. People have like a couple spoonfuls of kimchi a day to, you know, keep their stomach normal, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. And there it is. And so something that we've taken for, or at least always avoided, kimchi, if we start looking at it in a different light, just the reading of your Korean section, I thought, boy, I've got to run out and get some kimchi right away. Next country, China. I studied Chinese for 3 years, Chinese language for 3 years. And
oh, wow.
I went home to Montana. And there was my mom in the kitchen with a great big huge wok, having the time of her life. And it was like, you know, she got to discover China as I did. It was a lot of fun. And we can do that by going to Chinese restaurants. But there's a lot of Chinese, different kinds of Chinese restaurants, right?
It's amazing. And I love the fact that your mom has a wok. I think that speaks volumes about, you know, the dining scene at large in America, that we've really opened our minds and our, you know, kitchen pantries to other cuisines and flavors. And cooking tools is so exciting. But, yeah, China's humongous. I mean, it's 1/4, I believe, of the world's population. So you can just imagine how many regional cuisines there are. And, you know, that's why I say we speak a new world of food, a new language of food. Like, we don't just eat Chinese food. We eat Sichuan. You know, we eat Cantonese. We eat Beijing. We eat Shanghai. And they all have their specialties and, you know, they all have their flavors. For instance, Cantonese is a very seafood-based
cuisine, right?
And most of their food is mild and, you know, fish-based, so they don't have a lot of the dark, sweet sauces that you'd find, say, in, you know, Shanghai cooking. And, you know, they don't have the mala, which is the peppercorns and the chilies, effect, the tongue-tingling, numbing effect that Sichuan food is so famous for and that you find in so many of their dishes, including hot pots and far beyond. So they really are very distinguished in their own cuisines in and of themselves because the country is so big. So it really makes, you know, discovering Chinese food, you could spend 365, you know, days a year eating different Chinese dishes from different parts of China and never get bored.
I think one of the most memorable restaurant dishes I've ever had was at this very famous restaurant out here in California called New Riverside. It was allegedly one of the 7 best Sichuan restaurants in the world, and they served up a dish called whole fish in hot bean sauce, and boy, they brought out this whole sea bass, fresh sea bass, smothered in hot bean sauce. And oh my God, I'll never forget that dish. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about eating our way around the world, and why not? Because we can with, and we can do it with Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com and also the author of Try This. And in her book, Try This, she tries that, and you can too. And that's what we're doing today. So which country do we want to eat next? Do stay tuned right back. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here. Today we're eating our way around the world with Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com. She travels around the restaurants in New York City and environs and finds the best restaurants and has a wonderful adventure doing it, and so do the people who check out her website, as well as her book, Try This. So, you know, we were talking a little bit about British food and Chinese food, but one of the things that you do and Try This is talk about the manners of eating it in these various countries, like Chinese food. So would you care to talk a little bit about the manners of how to eat Chinese food?
Sure.
For us poor, you know, poor boys from Montana that, you know, have a hunting knife in one hand and a fork in the other.
yeah, I'll have to come eat there soon. I'm sure that there's a lot of new and exciting restaurants there as well. But, well, you won't get a knife. I'd be really surprised if you've got a knife on your table. And if you ask for a knife, you may not receive one because knives are generally seen as bad luck.
Bad luck?
In Chinese culture, it's viewed as a weapon. It's really not necessary if you think about it because most of the food, including the fish and obviously meats and vegetables, is cut up very small. So there's really no need for a knife. And you do already have your chopsticks. And I remember the first time I asked for a knife, and it was like this passive-aggressive ignoring me. And it's because, you know, they just don't have them, or they perceive them as, you know, bad luck, and people are superstitious, and, you know, they don't want you eating that way in their restaurant. But if you cut, another reason is, if you cut a noodle, it's also bad luck because it gives you, it shortens your life because noodles symbolize longevity, which is another reason why they slurp their noodles in China, which is totally fine and acceptable and good manners there. So you should feel free to slurp your noodles and lift your bowl right up to your...
You know, that's what I remember about eating in Asia is that, by and large, you ate out of bowls and you kind of scooped things in.
Exactly.
With your chopsticks.
Yeah, and eating fast is absolutely fine there as well. Another thing I thought was very interesting was, you know, being loud in a Chinese restaurant. Well, first of all, walking into a loud, noisy restaurant is always a good sign. Mm-hmm. But also, if you were loud about the food, it was very flattering to the chef.
So if you slurped around a lot, everybody was happy.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, they're very, like, if you notice in a Chinese restaurant, a lot of it's a very sort of family-oriented business, and you'll see them coming over to the table a lot because, you know, they're very proud of their food, and so they really appreciate thank yous and encouragement and positive reinforcement and enjoying and noises like you're enjoying food. And all that, you know, all different cultures have all different nuances and table settings and table manners. I'll never forget. I eat by myself a lot at lunch, not usually at dinner, but I never mind eating alone. But so I, you know, when I go to Koreatown in New York or L.A. or anywhere else that has a Koreatown, I would stop in by myself, and people always sort of looked at me strangely, and I never understood why, but it's because in Korean culture, it's not traditional, and it's sort of, you know, seen as it's just odd and awkward and sad to Koreans to eat by yourself. So when you come, you make them uncomfortable by eating by yourself. That doesn't mean I'm not going to go and not eat by myself. I'd rather enjoy my Korean food. Mike, you also should cover your mouth in front of your elders when you're drinking alcohol in a Korean restaurant. So it's not that you can't have alcohol. You just have to cover your mouth and almost hide it, which is this very funny.
How do you do that?
I mean, you hold one hand over your mouth and you put your beer, you know, on your lips with the other.
Interesting.
Yeah, and
I guess I better remember that one.
Yeah, you have to. Yes, and you know, it's just, there's many nuances. Like for instance, everything's shared in Korean food. So the only thing that's really not is a soup, but a stew is. So you know, if you hogged a dish, you hogged your bibimbap, you hogged barbecue or pickled vegetables or banchan, which are the small little side dishes that are, you know, complements of the house that come out with dishes to, you know, complement and balance all the flavors in the food. It's all shared. And
well,
if you
know,
you take one as your own, you're selfish.
Amen. And now, as long as we're talking about Korea food, something about it really rang true to me as being like the ultimate winter food. And coming from, you know, Montana, and I guess that would be a pretty good thing to think about. But soups and stews and pots and pies, and it just seems like the Koreans have and barbecues as well.
I couldn't agree with you more. When I think of comfort foods around the world, the first one I think of is Korean food because it is so warm and comforting and gratifying. You think of a dish like bibimbap that has so much going on. And, you know, Koreans are all about balance. So something hot with something cold, something spicy with something sweet or sour, which is why you get all the little side dishes. But you think of a bibimbap and you get a cold raw egg and warm, glutinous, sticky rice and, you know, your pickled vegetables and your juicy meat on top. And it's just like a bowl of comfort. You know, it's this very gratifying cuisine, and that's so true of their stews and soups and noodle dishes and porridges. I mean, I love their porridges, pumpkin porridges and abalone porridge, and it's just this really warm, gratifying food.
Well, if you were to take some newcomers into a Korean restaurant, take us through a meal.
Well, first things first is there's really no appetizers, entrees, or desserts. And whatever you think will come first probably won't come first. So, for instance, if you order soup, it will probably come later in the meal because Koreans actually see that more as an entree, even though they don't have courses. It usually doesn't come first. Things that you would get first are things like kimchi. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you get to a Korean restaurant, you order kimchi. Kimchi isn't just made with cabbage in Korea. It's made with any vegetables, you know, from radishes to carrots and eggplant and beyond. And you start with that, and sometimes they'll give you scissors at the table to cut up your own. So they might give you a big head of cabbage or, you know, a whole eggplant, and then you cut it up yourself. And it's sort of almost like invigorating your palate, like waking it up. And then you'll start to get a procession of banchan, which could be anything from a simmered dish, you know, a steamed dish, tofu. It could be mussels and chilies. It could be really, really anything. I mean, the world is sort of your oyster. They do, you know, acorn jelly. They play with textures. And they actually have sushi too, though I don't think that's the first thing I'd recommend, going to a sushi, to a Korean restaurant.
Right.
And then finally you get, if you're having barbecue, you get Korean barbecue, which is, if anybody's been to a Korean barbecue restaurant, it's do-it-yourself. And, you know, they open the grill in the middle of the table and you cook it yourself. And depending on what you order, whether you're getting bulgogi or whether you're getting pork ribs or something like that, you know, you throw it on for a minute and it's cooked and it's done, and you sort of play with the flavors yourself. So you have your banchan on the table, and you have your, you know, tofu, and then you mix that with the succulent sweet meat. And Korean barbecue is one of my very favorites.
And you've got me going, I'll tell you what. And Bill Grath, the engineer, is over here. He's drooling, too, so we're on it. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Mike Olson here. Today we're eating our way around the world with Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com, author of Try This. And we are trying this today by tasting our way around the world. What should we eat next? Which country should we eat next? Should we go to? Should we eat France? Should we eat Greece? What do you think? We will be right back after these messages. Do stay tuned. Well, welcome back. This is The Food Chain Radio Program. Mike Olson here. Today we're eating our way around the world. And which country should we eat at? We decided to kind of skip over Cuba and France and Greece for a moment to go right for the heart of things, which of course would be Thailand. We all love Thai food, do we not? And why is it that we all love Thai food, Danielle?
Well, that's a really good question. I personally love Thai food because every flavor is accounted for in it. So I call it the S factor of Thai food. You have spicy, sweet, sour, salty, all simultaneously. And it's not that the flavors cancel each other out. It's that you actually get each one. So it's this real, like, symphony of flavors in your mouth. And not only flavors, but textures as well. You know, you usually get crunchy peanuts or papaya. You'll get succulent meat. You'll get chilies. You'll get a little fish sauce. You'll get something sour. You get a little honey. So you get something sweet. And honestly, most of all, Thai food is, it's a sultry food. It's exotic, and it has these beautiful flavors like coconut milk and, you know, lemongrass and lime juice, and uses a lot of seafood. And one of my favorite parts of it is, of course, the rice. And, you know, they're really, rice is a staple in the culture, and they use it. It's really the main course in every meal. Most people think of it as a side dish, but that's not true in Thailand. And they have so many, you know, types. They have sticky rice. They have coconut rice. One of my favorites is chicken rice, which is literally rice cooked in chicken fat. They have jasmine rice. They have purple rice, which is black rice that turns purple. And it's, you know, just different. And they all have their own nuances and flavors. And it's really very exciting. And I love the way Thai eat their rice, because they actually treat it sort of like Play-Doh, and they mold it with their hands. They scoop it up and eat it that way.
With their hands?
Yeah, you can eat with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unfortunately, that's not really that accepted here, though I'm still trying to make that happen. Every time I go out to dinner.
There's Danielle with her hands in the Thai bowl.
Okay. But I love it. I mean, you know, you think about it and you go, it's like a little vacation every time
right.
you go.
That's right. And, you know, that's what Bill Graff and I were talking about, you know, when I suggested that my question for the day was, well, which country do we want to eat tonight? And it is like that. It's, where are we going tonight? We're not just going to eat out. We're going out. We're traveling. We're experiencing the world and through the world's food. And it is an adventure.
No, you're right. If you close your eyes and you think of Thai food, you do think of the lemongrass and the coconut milk and the limes and the little bit of the chilies and the papaya and all these things that remind you of hot weather and the beach and water and, you know, a tropical place. And, you know, Thai food is different. It's really very exciting. It's got very different flavors and textures. Like we were saying with, you know, they eat weed lettuce and mixed with tomatoes and cucumbers for a salad, and that's not what they perceive as a salad there, and it's really a very unique and exciting experience.
What do they perceive as a salad?
Unripe papaya with sprouts and carrots and toasted peanuts and dried little dried baby shrimp and, you know, lots of fish sauce and chilies all tossed together, And that's a salad. Another salad they make, which is one of my favorite salads, is a ground pork salad with lots of chilies and toasted rice and lots of lime. So it's citrusy, but at the same time, it's succulent because it's ground pork, and at the same time, it's got spice because there's a chili kick behind it.
You know, I think you're kind of a spicy girl, so let me ask you this. Are there any high-latitude cuisines that you really like?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, the closer you get to the equator, the hotter the spices. I guess that's just my theory.
Oh. Well, you know, I talk about in the book, I am not, you know, my book is not fear factor food, and I'm not encouraging people to eat anything and everything, or if you have a timid palate, you know, order something spicy, something super spicy. I talk about, you know, the Thai have spicy superpowers. Like, you know, I'm
right.
wary of getting something super hot there. So for me, honestly, it's not about ordering something super spicy. It's about tasting the food and
right.
your comfort level and just getting out of your dining rut.
Well, okay.
And ordering from the other side of the menu, trying something oh. you've never had.
That being said, now, you know, the closer you get to the equator, the spicier the food. And the
food it cools you off.
Yeah, exactly. And the food is hotter. I mean, it's spicier. So that being said, I just wonder if there are any high-latitude countries that have a cuisine that appeals to you.
Well, I mean...
I mean, like Norway or Finland or something.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I like, you know, I like Scandinavian food. I think we're less exposed to it still. We certainly have places like Aquavit in New York and places like that. I just think we have it less accessible to us. So I do. I appreciate, you know, all foods. But I definitely love Southeast Asian foods a lot. And I
mm-hmm.
think they're very interesting. And, for instance, we're talking about Thai food. And one of my favorite discoveries was Thai dessert because I was always sort of very traditionalist about my desserts, and I loved American desserts or French desserts. I didn't think Italian desserts were that wonderful. And I discovered Thai desserts and how sticky and creamy and luscious they are, and, you know, the different puddings and the cold soups, the coconut milk soups with the tapioca and the longan fruits, and, you know, the different ways they flavor things. And I really fell in love with Thai desserts and the yolks that they, you know, serve in syrup, and it's a whole new world of dessert, you know?
Wow.
And so now when I crave dessert, honestly, like, I'll crave a Thai dessert. I don't always, you know, crave some sort of American dessert. I find myself, like, when I get sick.
Okay.
Now getting chicken matzo ball soup, I'd rather have Korean samgyetang, you know, with a whole chicken or hen and ginseng and jujubes and garlic, or a Mexican pozole soup.
You got us on the floor with that one. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll conclude with Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com and the author of Try This. And we've been trying it, and it's been delicious. Do stay tuned right back. Welcome back, folks. Food Chain Radio. Michael Olson here. Today, we're eating our way around the world with Danielle Freeman, who is the host of RestaurantGirl.com and also the author of Try This. And we have been trying this. We have been trying foods all over the world, as we all should. I guess the question that all of us often ask ourselves and ask our family members and our roommates and whatnot is, hey, what country should we eat tonight? Which is to say, what ethnic food should we try? And that is the nature of eating out these days. And if you're eating out in New York, you have, what, a million different choices, Danielle? How many restaurants in New York City?
At least. Honestly, don't even know now. I think there's upwards of 15,000.
15,000 different choices. 15,000 places to eat when you go to eat out in New York City. But not much different at all the rest of the big cities in the country as well. We love to eat out. So, Danielle Freeman, as a restaurant critic, which is your favorite food? Which country do you like to eat the most?
Well, I definitely have a policy of not picking favorites. Cuisines, because I love them all and I appreciate them all, but I am quite partial to Japanese food, and I'm not just talking about sushi. I think when people think of Japanese food, they mostly think of sushi, but there are so many different genres of Japanese food. They have their own robata, they have yakitori, They have vegetarian tasting menus called Kaiseki. They have izakayas, which are Japanese pubs, which I adore and just was in one last night. So they have robotic grills, which are like open fire cooking, and the chef cooks right in front of you with paddles and chants lots of fun things. And
they're kind of like the ultimate showman when it comes to serving you food, aren't they?
Oh, they love it. You're absolutely. You know, they're very prideful, and presentation is so important. And food is such a big part of their world that, you know, they take the time when you're eating to have a lot of ceremonies and to clap and, you know, to do lots of things like a mochi pounding ceremony. And, yeah, they really see food. I mean, I think they also honor the world and the seasons that way, too. If you notice, your garnish is often a leaf if it's autumn. And, you know, it just really depends on the season. So they're very prideful and presentation. And, you know, if I could tell anybody the next time they go out for Japanese food to not go for sushi and try a different kind, whether that be yakitori, rabata, or kaiseki, because there are so many other genres of Japanese food to discover.
Well, now I'm totally starved. But I want to thank restaurant girl Danielle Freeman for joining us today. Her book, Try This, But If You Will, You Will Try That, and you will gain 50 pounds just like I did talking with her on the phone today. What about it out there? Which food, which country should we eat tonight? You can play with that on the forum page at metrofarm.com. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us. What fun. And,
thank you for having me, Michael.
I'm going to tune in. Next time I go to the city, I'm tuning in restaurantgirl.com.
I'll make you a list.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.